One of the things that's always stood in the way of me truly staying on top of my health is how expensive and annoying it is to get tests done. When I was experimenting during my quote unquote year of health, which I wrote about in my last book, The Wellness Project, I had to pretty much rely on my own obsessive journaling to see how various changes to my diet and lifestyle were affecting my symptoms. Sure, I got my thyroid panel done every few months, but it was hard to monitor things consistently and get a bigger picture of what was moving the needle. Had I had access to Verisana's at-home testing kits back then, it would have been a total game changer. For those of you who don't know, Verisana is one of the industry leaders for at-home testing for everything from women's hormone health to leaky gut to stool analysis. And their new offering is a monthly subscription called the Verisana Health Club that lets you detect risk factors and diseases before they break out. So how it works is every month they send you comprehensive labs in an optimized order. So the at-home tests use your blood, saliva, hair, and stool to measure things like cholesterol, hormones, toxic metals, and other issues across a wide array of health assays. If you're still trying to get to the bottom of what's going on with your health or simply want a more user-friendly system for monitoring improvements, which is especially convenient in this COVID world, you don't have to leave your house, this program is an incredible solution. To find out more and join the club, you can visit www.verisana.com/healthclub. SIBO Made Simple listeners can get their first month of membership for free by using the code SIBO2020 at checkout. The link is in the show notes. And again, that is SIBO2020, all one word, at checkout for your first month of tests free. Hello and welcome to SIBO Made Simple, a podcast for those recently diagnosed or chronically fighting small intestine bacterial overgrowth and a host of other gut-related things, as is certainly the case in today's episode. Before we get into the nitty-gritty, just want to say to all you beautiful people, all of you listeners, that I hope you had a fun yet small, safe Thanksgiving. I had a really, really nice one. It was actually, you know, so low stress not to have one person kind of cooking for the masses. We had a very small gathering with my parents and another couple outdoors on the screen porch, and it was perfect. And you know what? It was actually quite nice for myself, who is dietarily challenged, to have an entire menu that I could eat. So even though the feast was smaller, I would say that I still successfully did a lot of gorging. Which brings me to one fun thing I wanted to mention right up front, which is that I put up a whole host of new cooking classes onto my class schedule. We'll now be doing these bi-monthly, and the next one is actually tonight at 6:30 p.m. EST. The topic is everyday detox, and we're making two of my favorite, really easy to digest low FODMAP recipes from the SIBO Made Simple book. Friendly reminder that if you've already pre-ordered the book, you get access to one free class as part of your bonus package. So simply go to the link in the show notes to check that out. If you want to join us last minute, there's still time, there's still space. And if you read the class description, you can see info on how to submit your book receipt to get the free coupon code. And if you haven't bought the book yet, but maybe joining this class for free is a good impetus, you can also just go right to my class page, and there is an option to do a book plus class package. It is the exact same price as the cost of the book plus shipping. So you get the class for free still, and you can do it all right there under one roof. All right, today's episode is one I've really been looking forward to sharing. It is all about the endometriosis SIBO connection. So for those of you who don't think you know anyone with endo, you probably do, you just don't know it, because it affects 10% of women. And yet often it takes a woman 10 plus doctor's visits in order to get diagnosed, which is incredibly frustrating. And I know even those without endo, a lot of SIBO amigos out there can identify with that. It is an inflammatory condition by nature, and as it develops, it can put a huge strain on the digestive system, leading to a lot of IBS symptoms and often SIBO. So joining me to discuss how to heal the gut while tackling endo through more invasive measures is Dr. Iris Karen Orbach, the director of the Advanced Gynecologic Laparoscopy Center in Los Angeles and the author of the book, Beating Endo, How to Reclaim Your Life from Endometriosis. So as some of you who have endo probably know, the cornerstone of treatment is surgical excision of the endometriosis. But Dr. Karen Orbach also understands the importance of incorporating integrative medicine and combining Eastern and Western medicine approaches in helping her patients heal and getting them on the road to recovery. A quick taste of what we'll cover, we'll talk about what endometriosis is and why it's so hard to diagnose, overlapping conditions from autoimmune diseases to gut disorders, and specifically painful bladder syndrome, also known as interstitial cystitis, ways to heal after endosurgery that would make someone less likely to develop SIBO, how to manage the emotional stress of dealing with both endo and SIBO, and all the ways that we can limit systemic inflammation through diet. Friendly reminder, as always, if you like this podcast, don't just give us your stars, give us your reviews, although we would like that too, but also share us with a friend. And now, probably the best way that you could ever support the podcast is to buy the SIBO Made Simple book, which is out, oh my God, in just a little over a month, January 12th. It'll be here before we all know it. And of course, even if you're buying it early, one of the benefits is A, that it helps me get this book in the hands of more bookstores and tells the publisher that I'm someone worth investing in. But it's also good for you because you get all these free bonuses, including my Gut Heal Boot Camp, which you can access right away, and access to one of my free classes. And there are a bunch of those coming up that I'm very excited about. They almost all feature an advanced exclusive recipe from the book, if not two or three. And it's just been really fun getting to cook with you all face to face and having these kind of joint parties from afar in your own kitchen. Without further ado, let's talk to Dr. Iris Karen Orbach all about SIBO and endo. Thank you, Dr. Karen Orbach, for coming on the show. I'm really excited because we've had tons of listeners ask for endometriosis content, and you are one of the leaders in the field and are very familiar with SIBO, so the double whammy.
So happy to be here. Thank you.
So I feel like I also have a lot of listeners who fall into the bucket of mysterious symptoms that have never actually been diagnosed as anything. So I would love to just do like endometriosis 101 for those people, what it is, why it's so hard to diagnose, and what are the range of symptoms?
Sure, sure. And I think that's the best question to start with, honestly, because most people who even have endometriosis don't really know the definition of what it is. So first of all, it's such a common disease. At least 10% of women have it. It's about translating to about 200 million women worldwide. So it's a lot of women. Symptoms are very different between patient to patient. Typically, there's either a GYN manifestation or a GI manifestation or a urological manifestation or a infertility manifestation. So we'll break down each one. So from a gynecological perspective, patients often report either painful periods or pelvic pain that can be before their period, after their period, honestly, all month long. Mm-hmm. Most typically also have painful sex. They report it usually as like deep positional painful sex rather than on insertion. From a GI perspective, and I would have to say that most of my patients have GI manifestations and most actually present with GI symptomatology. And that's being either constipated or having diarrhea or alternating constipation and diarrhea, bloating and painful bowel movements. Some patients have urological symptoms that would be urinary frequency, getting up at nighttime to urinate, painful urination. And then from an infertility perspective, if someone has infertility, about 50% of the blame for the infertility is actually because of endometriosis.
Wow.
So everyone has different symptoms, but the symptom that I see most in my practice is GI. And that's how I became, I'm kind of like obsessed with SIBO, obsessed with nutrition. I'm a health junkie. And if I can tell you how many patients because I take an extensive history in my patients when I meet them. And I always go back. They all say, okay, my symptoms started 1 year ago or 6 months ago. Mm-hmm. And I say, let's go back to your childhood. Mm-hmm. And many report, yeah, I had constipation since I was a kid, or I've had bloating since I was a kid. I was diagnosed with IBS when I was 20 or 15. And even in young teens who are coming to me with awfully painful periods, I go back in time and I say, do you have any GI symptoms? And they say, oh yeah, 2 years before I even start my period, I developed terrible constipation or bloating. And it's that inflammatory impact of endometriosis. So endo is an inflammatory disorder. When one has endo, it increases their likelihood of having all these other autoimmune disorders. So what is endo? So endo is when you have cells that are similar to the lining of your uterus, that's known as the endometrium, but those cells are found outside of the uterus. So if we can kind of picture our uterus, in the inside of our uterus, we have a lining that's called the endometrium. And every month that lining gets thicker and thicker and thicker. And if we're not pregnant, we shed that period or that lining on a monthly basis. So those cells are called endometrial cells. And essentially, when you have cells that are similar, they're not identical to those cells, but they're found outside of the uterus, then what happens on a monthly basis when exposed to estrogens and progesterones, like our regular hormones that are coming from our ovaries, the lining of the uterus is getting thicker and thicker and then shedding. So too are those implants that are found outside of our uterus. They too are getting thicker and thicker, but the problem is there's no exit point in our pelvis. So month after month after month, those cells get thicker and thicker and thicker. And one can have intestinal symptoms like I had described, whether it's constipation, diarrhea, bloating, or alternating constipation, diarrhea, even if you don't have endometriosis implants on the bowel. And that's a little fact that I think is so important that most gynecologists and I believe most GIs are not aware of that. And they did a study and they looked at patients who preoperatively had those symptoms, GI symptoms, that only transferred to 8% of patients who actually had endo on the bowel.
Wow.
And the reason why is because there's this inflammatory component of endo. Those implants aren't only painful, they're also pro-inflammatory, and then they're throwing off everything in the vicinity. And because there's a delay in diagnosis of endo of 10 years, it's pretty crazy. And that means we are suffering for so long before we're even having a diagnosis. You can imagine the body's in such an inflammatory state from head to toe. And that's why there's such a whole host of intestinal symptoms and other symptoms throughout the body.
So you're saying it's not necessarily always structural, just like having those cysts, growths, I'm not even sure of the correct terminology of, you know, the growths outside the uterus pressing into other organs, but just simply the way the disease operates in the body in general and how it affects just everything.
It's a combination of both. So because those implants, you can imagine them on a monthly basis, are getting thicker and thicker and thicker and thicker, they're also distorting the anatomy. So they are creating a structural alteration, which does translate to pain, but those implants are also inflammatory. And they're just, can you imagine 10 years of inflammation building up? Ugh. It goes all over the body. So it's a combination of structural as well as inflammatory.
So I'm so glad you brought up the example of patients that you had experiencing symptoms before they even got their period, because I guess I just never really thought about when this type of disease actually develops. Can you be born with endometriosis? What are the predispositions of what's the like climax event that kind of causes it to, I don't know, present itself?
So I'm going to tell you about this really interesting study that's going to answer that question. So some researchers wanted to look at female fetuses who unfortunately passed away. Let's say there was a auto accident, a car accident, and there was blunt trauma to the abdomen. The mom was fine, but the fetus passed away. So they did autopsies on all these female fetuses, and they found that 9% of female fetuses have endometriosis. So that number, right? Is that crazy? That number is not too dissimilar to the number that we quote in the general population being roughly about 10-ish percent. So what we do know, if there's a family history of endo, it can be on the mom's side, it can be on the dad's side, that can be passed down genetically So if the mom has it, the aunt has it, a sister has it, and again, it can be the aunt on the dad's side, then that baby or fetus or kid will have a 7 to 10-fold higher likelihood of having endo. So if we say that the general population, there's a 10% likelihood, then there's almost, it's almost like a sure thing that that person is going to have endometriosis. So there's the genetic component. And then we also know during pregnancy, when the fetus is in the mom, when there's exposure to dioxins, dioxins are byproducts of bleaching, which we know are just poison. We know that in mice models that causes endometriosis. And I'm sure there's so many other chemicals out there. And that's kind of why I'm a health junkie, that alters our DNA and that can predispose us to endometriosis, plus a whole host of other, you know, awful things.
Environmental.
In our body. So let's say I see an 18-year-old in my office and she says, oh yeah, I've had painful periods since I was 13. So it's not that she's had pain from, you know, 18 minus three, whatever, 5 years. Chances are she's been in this inflammatory state since she was born. So that's why also there's so many GI issues and other systemic symptoms, because the body's in this inflammatory state.
Wow. So that study that you mentioned, when they're autopsying the fetuses, are they actually seeing lining developing outside the uterus at such a young fetal stage, or is there some other test? Because I guess my very vague understanding of endometriosis is that one of the reasons why it takes 10 years to diagnose is that there's just not kind of an easy one and done blood test for it.
Right. So definitely that's part of it. Just to be clear, it's not identical to the lining of the uterus. It's pretty similar, because like a bunch of doctors, and when I was in residency, I was taught that endo is caused by retrograde menstruation, meaning the lining of the uterus backflowing into the pelvis. That is not the case. So the implants are similar to the lining of the uterus, but not identical to it. So on that study, they literally excised areas that were outside of the uterus, and they find these certain cells. They're called endometrial glands and stroma, and that's how we make the diagnosis of endometriosis. So you're right, the 10-year delay in diagnosis is because we don't have a blood test. Ultrasounds are normal. We don't see endo on imaging. Once in a while, we may see it on an MRI, but chances are it's not going to pick it up. We really have to go by history, but the problem is most doctors are not taught about endo properly in residency. So I did 4 years of OBGYN residency before I did a fellowship in minimally invasive surgery where we were focusing on endo. I was just really blessed to be working with two amazing mentors. I always tell people I learned more in my first week of fellowship than I did in 4 years of OBGYN training, right? So I was never taught about GI manifestations. I was never taught about urological manifestations. I barely even knew what endometriosis looked like at the time of laparoscopy. And I would have to say most of what I practice in medicine today has been because I have just been a really curious, I'm a curious sort, and I've been trying to put the pieces together about endo. I learned how to do the right surgery for endo, which is called excision of endo. That's cutting out those implants. But as my practice really started to focus on endometriosis patients and less general gynecology over the years, I started noticing these patients describing similar symptoms. And I started collaborating with gastroenterologists and integrative docs and integrative nutritionists and all these integrative people. And I was trying to figure out what is going on. Why does this implant in the pelvis, if it's not near the intestines, why does that cause, for instance, SIBO? Or why does that cause all these, you know, fatigue and exhaustion? And I've just been on a, honestly, on a quest to figure it out. I was never taught any of this in residency. And that's, you know, what prompted me to write my book, which came out last summer, well, I guess summer of 19, Beating Endo, How to Reclaim Your Life from Endometriosis. Because my approach to getting my patients better, it's not I meet them and I say, okay, let's book you for surgery in 2 weeks. I love to operate, but I try and identify all the reasons why patients with endo who've been having these symptoms for years, what else is going on contributing to their pain because of endometriosis being undiagnosed for years? I try and do all these nutritional things, get them to eat right. We deal with anxiety, depression. We try and get them healthy. I send them for pelvic floor physical therapy, you know, evaluate them for SIBO. We get them treated. I get them to do meditation, mindfulness. We're calming down the central nervous system. And then I do the right surgery, which really is the cornerstone for endometriosis treatment, which is excision of endometriosis.
Right. So you mentioned pelvic floor therapy. Can you go into that a little bit more about why it's so important?
Yeah, absolutely. So let's say someone has constipation because they're endometriosis. If we take a step back and we just talk about normal bowel habits. So let's say I need to have a bowel movement. I'm going to sit on the toilet. And theoretically, what should happen are the muscles that are in my pelvic floor that are around my rectum and around my vaginal opening and around my bladder, like everything should relax, right, to allow stool to pass. But if someone's constipated, what's happening is they're sitting on the toilet for extended periods of time and they're like literally pushing and pushing and trying to force out their stool. So what's happening, those pelvic floor muscles are tightening and tightening and tightening and squeezing. And often most of my patients report that they sit for 10 minutes, 20 minutes, a half an hour, multiple times a day. They start moving around on the toilet to get their stool to come out. Some people put their feet up. So what happens are the pelvic floor muscles get very tight. And the same thing happens for the muscles around the vaginal opening. If someone's experiencing painful sex, they start squeezing, right? So those muscles are getting tight. And same thing for the muscles around the bladder. If someone feels like I have to urinate frequently because they feel they need to urinate, but there's not much urine there, which happens in some patients with endo, there's that similar, instead of relaxing the muscles to allow for the urine to pass, it's the squeezing and pushing. So one of the first stops with my patients, I would say 99% of my patients who come to me have pelvic floor tight muscles. And I have them work with a pelvic floor physical therapist. It's not a PT who does shoulders or knees or car accidents. It's someone who literally that's what they do. They're pretty hard to find. They are amazing and transformative for my patients. And I think, honestly, for most patients, I think anyone who has a baby or any human being who goes to SoulCycle or works out crazy or is a runner really should do pelvic floor PT, because all of our muscles, our legs, our back, everything's connecting to our hips and our pubic bones and our pelvic bones. Yeah. So pelvic floor PT is life-changing for patients.
Very cool. Well, I'm curious, like, is constipation on the grand scheme of these IBS symptoms more common in endo patients than diarrhea? And if so, is that one of the reasons why SIBO, I mean, I think there are many reasons, but why SIBO is such an overlap with endo patients?
I haven't seen literature as to what percentage have constipation and then are diagnosed with endo versus diarrhea versus alternating constipation and diarrhea. I see both. I do anecdotally would have to say constipation is more prevalent. But from the SIBO perspective, right, if there's constipation, there's backflow, they're not evacuating properly. But I also think it's this inflammatory implant that is just setting off inflammation throughout the body, right? Because I look at endo more as like an autoimmune disease. And any autoimmune disease that someone has, they're going to have a higher likelihood of SIBO because it's like longstanding inflammation. And when one has endo, you have a higher likelihood of other autoimmune diseases. Many of my patients have Hashimoto's, a bunch have celiac, or they have like slightly positive ANA antibodies, like that is, which is a marker of autoimmune disease. But the doc's like, yeah, it's positive, but it's not high enough to be called lupus or to be called some other autoimmune disease. So I think, yes, I hear more constipation, but I think it's also this just whole systemic inflammatory approach that I see. The connection that I see with SIBO is also a connection of what I see with my patients who have something called interstitial cystitis or painful bladder syndrome. And when we look at, from my understanding, SIBO on a microscopic level, there's these mast cells that are releasing histamine. And many of my patients who have endo have something going on with their bladder, and we can't decide, do we call it interstitial cystitis or painful bladder syndrome? No one can really decide what we call it. So I'll just call it interstitial cystitis or IC. And studies have shown that of patients who have endo, at least half of them have interstitial cystitis. And there's other studies that show 92% of endo patients have interstitial cystitis. So you're probably like, why is she talking about IC? What does this have to do with anything? But interstitial cystitis is also known as pelvic pain of bladder origin. And many of my interstitial cystitis patients have bloating as one of their big side effects, mm-hmm. or other GI symptoms like nausea. Some people have urological side effects, gynecological side effects. But what's happening microscopically in the bladder is the same thing that's happening microscopically in the small intestine, which is mast cells are releasing histamine. So I don't know if patients have a higher likelihood of SIBO because they also have a bunch of other inflammatory issues that are going on that have same pathophysiologies with histamine being released or not. So I'm not sure if it's just the constipation effect. Is it just whole systemic body-wide inflammation? But I definitely see this correlation in my patients who have SIBO, who also have interstitial cystitis as well. And when I treat them both, both of my patients get better. The SIBO symptoms get better and their bladder symptoms get better.
Wow.
It's really peculiar.
What is the treatment for that?
The way that I approach it, like how I approach everything in my practice, is dietarily. That's the first thing that I do. Mm. I hate to throw medicines at people. So typically for the bladder, foods that are really high in acid and very high in potassium irritate the bladder. And the acids and the potassiums that are in the bladder kind of permeate through the walls of the bladder. That's known as the interstitium of the bladder. And that's how they got the name interstitial cystitis. But acids and potassiums are very common. So acids, a lot of my patients these days are drinking kombucha and sparkling water, right? You know, people who are attracted to me because I have a nutritional, I'm like a triathlete human being, they're all workouters. They come in with like a tall bottle of Smart Water. Smart Water adds potassium. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the waters that we drink add potassium. Acids are in citrus fruits and tomatoes and spicy foods and a lot of the same foods that can cause reflux to patients. Mm-hmm. And B complex vitamins, turmeric can cause irritation to the bladder. So what's kind of crazy is we call this pelvic pain of bladder origin, but many of my interstitial cystitis patients, they present with a whole host of other symptoms, like I was saying, bloating, or they have yeast infections, or they feel like their periods are worse. It can be gynecological, urological symptoms, GI symptoms. It's just like there is, once our central nervous system's flared from these 10 years of pain, then we get these nonspecific symptoms that really cross all different organ systems.
Wow. So for those who aren't necessarily IC patients, uh-huh. who are looking for a dietary approach, what are kind of the broad strokes? And does like a low histamine diet factor in if there's so many mast cell issues?
So what's kind of neat, a lot of patients by the time they come to me, because I'm kind of like, I'm not their last ditch effort, but they've really researched a lot by the time they've gotten to me. And many patients have been on every diet, whether it's low FODMAP, you know, anti-candida, antihistamine, keto, like anti-inflammatory. Most of them are gluten-free, dairy-free, sugar-free by the time they get to me. So I honestly think eating all organic, eating clean, no preservatives, anti-inflammatory diet is really the best to approach endometriosis. I do have patients who have lots of hives and they get hives for just no reason, or they get hives for a reason. And those are the ones who have, I think, a lot of mast cells releasing histamine, whether it's from SIBO, whether it's from IC. The endo implants also release histamine amongst a bunch of other things. And I find that they may benefit from an antihistamine. But in general, anti-inflammatory, buying everything organic, green, and that's like, I think, the best approach, whether you have endo or not, in this crazy, environmentally toxic world we live in.
Totally. You guys are always asking me for transcripts and printouts of all the SIBO Amigo Digest tips that I've gathered over the course of 4 seasons of this podcast. But I've done you one better and distilled all of the practitioner advice and how-tos into a 400-page full-color Bible that is being published by Hachette Go. Yes, SIBO Made Simple is now a book, and it's part patient guide, part cookbook, complete with over 90 low FODMAP recipes. I wrote it to be your trusty roadmap that allows you to become your own intestinal detective, gut problem solver, and critter-free kitchen crusader. All the recipes are low FODMAP, soy optional, and completely free of gluten, corn, refined sugar, and dairy. But what I'm most proud of is that there is an incredibly comprehensive dietary restriction key, including labels on each recipe for avoiding sulfur, histamine, sugar, yeast, and adhering to some of the leading SIBO practitioner diets like the SIBO Specific Food Guide and the Biphasic Diet. Every single recipe also has an onward section with a recommendation on how to incorporate a new high FODMAP ingredient at a manageable dose so that you always have a way to safely diversify your diet. Also, the pictures are really pretty. The SIBO Made Simple book will be on shelves January 12th, but if you purchase today, you'll get free access to my 5-day Gut Heal Bootcamp meal plan and protocol. And those who pre-order will also get free access to one of my online cooking classes. To claim your bonuses, simply go to SIBOMadeSimple.com and follow the instructions for submitting your order receipt. I am so sincerely proud of this book, and I cannot wait for you to have it in your hands. Thank you, as always, for supporting my work. Now let's get back to the interview. So I know one of the SIBO risk factors of endo is, of course, the surgery itself and the potential adhesions that might be caused. I'm curious, like, what your recommendations are for your patients and anyone out there who, you know, has to have this type of surgery, what they can do afterwards to prevent a problem like SIBO from occurring.
Yeah. One of the first things I do if anyone has any GI symptoms is I always evaluate them for SIBO beforehand. So I think treating it beforehand, and I go both generally through an MD-GI, and I have an integrative nutritionist who I collaborate with. So it's not only treating whether they're methane or hydrogen positive. And by the way, I'm a huge fan of Dr. Pimentel, and I saw he was on your show. You know, I've been listening to his podcast for years, and I think he's amazing. So I believe in everything that he says. I also work with an integrative nutritionist who starts to boost up my patient's gut. So I do that pre-surgically, typically, if the patients are interested in doing it and they want to do it. And then in my hands, I don't do that many repeat surgeries. I'd say my repeat operation rate's about 5%. And I think technique has a lot to do with adhesion. So we do know that any surgery, you're right, can increase adhesion formation. A cut open surgery called a laparotomy would increase adhesion formation a lot more than a laparoscopic surgery, which is minimally invasive. And because such a large component of my patients want childbearing, whether it's in 5 years, 10 years, 2 years, they've been trying for 5 years, my technique when I operate is I'm pretty OCD in the OR. I'm very meticulous. I don't like having bleeding. I'm always irrigating the pelvis so we don't leave any debris that can cause adhesion. So I have not reoperated on a patient for adhesions in, I don't even remember when I did. However, when I was a fellow, just about every one of our surgeries, now that was like 17 years ago, was a repeat surgery for adhesions. And we had this whole subset of patients who it was just like adhesion, adhesion, adhesion surgery, because their initial surgeries were done with the wrong kind of surgery. So what's crazy is 99% of doctors are doing the wrong surgery for endometriosis. So the proper surgery, as I mentioned, was excision of endo. That's literally cutting out those implants. What I learned how to do in residency was called, well, it was the wrong surgery. It's called ablation of endo. Some people call it burning or fulguration or cautery. But that's a very superficial removal of the endo. So imagine like that implant's a bit deeper. It just burns the tip of that implant and then it causes more scarring. So if I'm going to operate on someone and they've had an ablation surgery before me, I know it's going to be an absolute disastrous mess when I get to them in the operating room. Mm-hmm. So the big thing is to make sure you find a doctor who does the right surgery, and that's excision of endometriosis. So it's usually a specialist, and there's not that many out there. I just really would recommend do not have surgery from a general OBGYN. Like, God bless a general OBGYN. I could never be one. They have to know, you know, how do you manage an abnormal pap smear? What do you do if someone has triplets? How are you going to deliver those three babies? What if a postmenopausal woman has a breast lump? What do you do if someone gets gonorrhea or chlamydia? How do you treat diabetes in pregnancy? Meaning their breadth is so wide that their depth can't be deep, right? Mm-hmm. And I just do one thing and like, that's it. So my depth can be really deep. So I think the best way to prevent SIBO because of adhesion formation is having a good surgery by a really qualified excision surgeon.
Got it. Well, for the people who maybe are listening to this and going, oh, shoot, who have maybe already had less than ideal surgeries, is there anything they can do now, any sort of structural therapy that can help them through potentially any lingering adhesions they might not even know about?
I think PT is great at visceral mobilization, visceral meaning like the viscera, like the organs, the intestines. I think that they definitely make them glide better. So doing that and then working with whether it's your GI or an integrative nutritionist to make sure if you have constipation from endo that you're on a whole regimen. So you're moving the stool and having proper bowel movements. And then I'm a big fan of boosting the gut. I'm a big fan of like herbals for maintenance for prevention of SIBO or treating it. I like integrative approach.
Totally.
And if someone's still symptomatic, chances are the burning didn't get rid of endo. It probably created more scarring and more issues to, you know, see if you need a proper surgery. I don't advocate, hey, come to my office, let me operate on you. That's not what but if you're symptomatic and you're having all these recurrent SIBO events, I've had patients who their GI finally sent them to me because they had 9 SIBO episodes, confirmation, like test positive. And then they're like, geez, I wonder if something else is going on. And then we remove their endo, we treat them with this multimodal therapy. And maybe once in a while, they feel a little bit and they take some herbals and they're okay. But I think we have to get rid of all the inflammatory components that are causing the SIBO.
Got it. Well, we had a few listener questions submitted, and I'm not sure if there is really an answer for this first one, but this person was curious whether or not endopeeps are more prone to methane or hydrogen SIBO.
That is such a good question. I love that. And I have to say, only the last couple of years have I been requesting for my patients to send me their SIBO tests. Because I'm primarily in Los Angeles, but I have patients from all over the country. And if it's the local providers who I'm sending the patients to get their SIBO test, then I get the results. So I've just been looking at it because I find that so many patients are actually even being treated incorrectly. If they have elevated methane, their doctors are just giving them Xifaxan. They're not even giving them neomycin. And my brother-in-law is a gastroenterologist, and we've collaborated a lot on patient care. But I see, and this is anecdotal, I see more hydrogen elevations than methane, but I do see methane. One of my patients yesterday was a methane positive. And I've seen people flip-flop, like they're hydrogen positive, and then at some point they then become methane as well. But there could be things happening in between there where they think they have a urinary tract infection, but it's actually interstitial cystitis, and then they go on a couple of different rounds of antibiotics. So I don't know, are the antibiotics then causing the flip-flop? I don't know, but I definitely have seen people who are only hydrogen then turn to be hydrogen and methane, even after treatment of Xifaxan, after that initial hydrogen positivity. It's all like really interesting to me.
And is there anything in the treatment of SIBO that would be different for an endo person?
I think a multimodal approach. So like I said, if someone has interstitial cystitis, I always try and get them at least for a few months while we're treating the SIBO to go off acids, potassiums, and I guide them really like thoughtfully so it's not so bad to get them off of those. And then I have a whole way I reintroduce them. And then concomitantly, I have them do like pelvic floor PT and I have them start eating well. So I think it would maybe the addition of evaluating for the bladder component and then having proper surgery.
Got it. Okay. One more listener question. How should I manage the emotional stress of dealing with both endo and SIBO? Can I get a break and only deal with one type of bloat? It's like a double whammy endo belly.
That's a great question. So I always tell my patients, you know, every patient goes to the doctor because whether they're having painful sex or they're having bad periods or pelvic pain, I mean, going to the gynecologist. And most tell me the same story, which is as follows. I went to 7 gynecologists and 7 of them over 10 years told me there was nothing wrong with me. So if I was in her shoes or his shoes, the patient's shoes, whatever, I would be depressed and anxious, right? Because I'm starting to doubt my own pain. So A, you're in pain. You can't go out. You're maybe withdrawing from hanging out with friends, or maybe you're not sexually active with your partner because it hurts. And so I'd become depressed and anxious if that was me. But then add on these years of going to doctor after doctor after doctor and being dismissed and saying, hey, have a glass of wine before you have sex. That'll solve your pain. If I had a penny for every time a patient told me that a gynecologist told her that, I think I could solve world hunger with that like jar of pennies. Because it's being told to patients over and over again. So what's important to understand is the same part of our brain that modulates anxiety or depression is kind of the same part of our brain that's modulating pain. So whenever I meet my patients for the first time, I'm also assessing for depression, anxiety, trauma, whether it's physical, emotional, sexual, whatever kind of trauma. And I do try and get my patients to address those as well, because what happens when you have those 10 years of pain from that implant, let's say you have this implant of endometriosis somewhere in the pelvis. What initially happens is there's a nerve fiber that goes from that implant to the central nervous system and starts to flare it. Over time, we know by studies that there's an increase in nerve density. So that initially, if there was one nerve flaring the central nervous system, now there's 2, then 3, then many over this 10 years where there's the diagnostic delay. What happens is the central nervous system starts to just almost flare on its own. Over those 10 years, then people develop tight muscles. That's flaring the central nervous system. They start developing bladder issues, and that's flaring the central nervous system. Whether they had depression before or it's worsened because of this dismissal, unfortunately, that's being done to patients from the brain, then that's flaring the central nervous system also. So I really encourage patients to address the mind, whether it's starting with meditation, mindfulness, breath work, or working with a pain therapist, because we want to identify and treat all reasons that are flaring our central nervous system. Because if we have multiple reasons for pain and we're leaving one firing and flaring our central nervous system, the way our bodies work, if we're depressed or we're anxious, that message is going to go from our brain back down to our central nervous system. And then that's going to aggravate all the reasons we have pain. So if we have period pain, it's going to make our period pain worse. And I give this example to patients, and this was a little bit more apt when I was working primarily in New York City where the weather was like horrible, but I would tell patients, like, let's say you take, you know, you're living in Manhattan, you have a really busy life, just living in Manhattan flares your sympathetic drive, and you go away and you have a gorgeous vacation, you come back and you feel so well rested. The day you come back from vacation, if it's raining and you're walking to the subway and the water from the bus driving along the street gets on your pant leg, and then you get down into the subway, then the subway is not there, and then crowds of people are bumping into you as you're descending the steps of the subway. I mean, you can picture it. I know your cell number was a 917 number. So
yes. Add a pandemic to all of this you're describing.
Right. I have a 917 cell number. I was in Manhattan for about 26 years. So if you came off a week of vacation, you'd probably be pretty annoyed, but you'd be okay if that was your first day back from vacation. However, if it was the day before you left from vacation, you hadn't been away for 4 to 6 months, if all of that happened, if you had pain, it would make your pain worse. If you were anxious, you'd want to punch that person who, you know, knocked into you on the steps as you were going down in the subway. You wouldn't have that resilience. Everything would hurt more, right? It would be harder for you to undo everything. So that silly example, I think, really typifies why we need to chill out the central nervous system. And we need to address all the different reasons. I don't know if that makes sense to you, but that makes sense to me. And
I think it's the avenue of SIBO recovery and really recovery from any sort of chronic illness that is just not given enough attention.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, one more question that I kind of have a feeling I know how you're going to answer it. This is a little random, but this person asks, are there any other antibiotics that work for borderline methane SIBO besides Xifaxan? I was given Cefoxitin, never heard of that one, during endosurgery, and my SIBO symptoms went away for a few weeks immediately after.
That's interesting. I mean, so there's such a crossover. Patients always use the term endobloat or endobelly. Mm-hmm. I am not so sure that endobloat and endobelly is just from endo. I actually think it's from SIBO, it's from endometriosis, it's from transit not being so great, you know, just from constipation. I think there's a component if they have interstitial cystitis that's causing the bloat. So the question is, only until we tease out and we treat all these things, do we really know what the bloat's coming from, if that makes sense, or the symptoms. So if they're borderline methane, I'd say neomycin also. But I think anyone borderline should be treated personally, whether it's by an herbal protocol or, you know, by antibiotics. So I'm not sure what that antibiotic is that you mentioned.
Okay. I've never heard of it either, but I'm not a doctor. Like, so
just to give you an example, you know, kind of more so answering your listener's question is that when I have patients come in for their initial consult, they're coming to me thinking endo is their only issue. And they're basically like, okay, well, can we schedule surgery next week? But I break down all their reasons why they have bloating. And then I set them on a course. Okay, do this, go to PT, get evaluated for SIBO, see me in 6 to 8 weeks. Okay, then they come back and let's say they haven't done the SIBO test yet, but they have it scheduled and they've only done PT in that 6 to 8 weeks. And they're like, wow, I'm pooping better. My bloating's a little better. Then they go and they have their SIBO test. And they're like, oh my gosh, I went on those antibiotics. And some people have worse symptoms initially, and then they're ultimately better. Only then can they realize, oh wow, my bloat's better from the SIBO treatment. And then I have them get treated for, let's say, interstitial cystitis. And then only when they do that and then add back foods can they recognize the bloating is from the IC. I think just bloating can be from everything.
That was one of my outstanding questions for you, is just since the symptoms can be so similar between endo and SIBO, and now my new found knowledge of IC, how does someone know whether or not to seek out an endo diagnosis, maybe if SIBO has been like their first discovery?
So I would say if anyone has painful periods, if anyone has deep penetration, painful sex, if they are having this recurrent SIBO and their doctor can't figure out it, then I would be evaluated from endo, but again, not from a generalist, because a generalist doesn't know anything about endo. They don't even know what SIBO is. So I definitely would recommend getting an evaluation for sure. And now when I get referrals from GIs, that's kind of what I have, this integrative doc who I love. I work with a lot of different ones, and it takes him 30 seconds to make the diagnosis, and his batting average is 100% right. So he's really big into SIBO testing. And if it's someone who is SIBO positive, he asks them like 5 questions. Do you have painful periods? Did you ever have painful periods? Do you have painful sex? If they are answering yes to any of those, he says, you got to go see Dr. Iris Karen Orbach. Like, and he sends them to me, and they come to me, they're like, I'm not sure why I'm here, but but Dr. So-and-so sent me. And then they say, oh, but I don't have any symptoms of endo. And then my consults are like an hour and a half or 2 hours long. And by the end, they're like, oh my gosh, I had no idea. Once I explain and tease apart everything, and then I figure it out. So,
wow. Well, so much to think about for people. Is there anything else that you want to add in the tips and tricks department for dealing with SIBO and or endo that people need to know? Anything dietary, supplement wise, or just strategy wise?
You know, more than anything, I want to say to who's listening is to trust your body and to trust yourself. If you're not feeling well, or you're not optimally living your life, or you're just exhausted, or you're withdrawing from doing those things that you love, keep searching till you find the answer. Don't let someone say your ultrasound's normal. There's nothing wrong with you. Because ultimately, I think we know ourselves really well and keep searching for the answer. And I think, unfortunately, when it comes to endo, you're going to find more on the internet than you will through a gynecologist. I wrote all the copy for my website. I wrote it, and it took me a couple of years. So if anyone wants to have more information about endo, my URL's lagyndr.com, like L-A-G-Y-N doctor, lagyndr.com.
Oh yeah. I'll link to it in the show notes.
And I have tons of info about endo. There's so much misinformation about endo online. So be really careful, because when the pharmaceutical industries want to treat a surgical disease with a medicine, you're going to find a lot of misinformation out there.
That's a good tip.
So you got to really know where you're looking.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. I think people are going to be really excited and learn a lot from this episode.
Thank you. And thank you. You've taught me so much. The people who you bring on, it's so fascinating how there's this common link with SIBO, with so many different disease processes. So thank you for teaching me as well.
All right. That was Dr. Iris Karen Orbach, an incredible resource for all things endo and SIBO. I loved her passion, and I think she's such an incredible advocate for women. So let's dive right into the SIBO Amigo Digest. Number one, 10% of all women have endo, and there's a big genetic component. So look at your family history, and then look at your long history, even before puberty, as it could have been presenting even then as various inflammatory issues. Number two, in regards to differentiating between SIBO and endo, if you have painful periods every month, painful sex, and or bladder problems, she recommends definitely investigating the endo side of the coin. Number three, I love that she brought up pelvic floor therapy as both a great tactic for SIBO and endo people who deal with frequent constipation and might be inadvertently tightening a lot of those center muscles that form the base of our tree trunk, of our torso, that are so important for many, many reasons. Number four, let's talk about painful bladder syndrome for a second. It's also known as interstitial cystitis, also known as PBS or IC. And one of the strategies that Dr. Karen Orbach recommends is a low acid and or low potassium diet, similar safe foods to a reflux diet, as a means of managing this type of condition. And number five, finally, for both SIBO and endo peeps, I loved her final reminder to trust your body and keep pushing for answers. The commonality, I feel like, of both of these conditions is that they get easily passed off by various practitioners as IBS or anxiety-related disorders. So keep on pushing, find a specialist who will look at the full picture, and more importantly, who knows what to search for when it comes to endo. All right, that is it for this week's episode. I hope you loved it as much as I did. If you did, please rate and review us on iTunes. It's how more people find the show. And of course, if you have any friends with endo or gut issues, please share this episode with them. And you know what? Maybe even consider getting them a copy of the SIBO Made Simple book for the holidays. They're coming up. I know you got a lot of gassy friends and family members out there. And even though it won't be on your doorstep until January 12th, it will make a fantastic pre-gift. You can even print out the free Gut Heal Bootcamp for them. That is one of the pre-order bonuses. You can just go to SIBOMadeSimple.com to download that. And I'll also add that there's still a huge issue of awareness for conditions like SIBO and endo. And I know it feels like I'm being selfish a lot of the time asking you guys to support me by pre-ordering the book. But honestly, it really does help with overall awareness, letting bookstores know, letting my publisher know that this is indeed something that affects tons of people. It's worth putting money behind. It's worth promoting. It's worth getting the word out there so that more people can find the help they need. All right, next week, we are going to be talking about another overlapping condition with SIBO that interests a lot of you, and that is Lyme and tick-borne illnesses. Until then, I am Phoebe Lapine, and this is SIBO Made Simple.